Tap by Mark Clapham. Welcome, St. Oscar's faculty and students, to this special Christmas celebration. I know many of you are only here because the Union Bar is closed for winter break. I sympathise and hope this lovely conference room will provide some kind of substitute, at least once you've had a complimentary brandy. Yes, Dr. Parvat, Joseph has gone to get that Malthusian rum. I'm sure he'll be back soon. For those of you who don't know, I'm Professor Bernice Summerfield, holder of the Edmund Watkinson Chair in Archaeology. I'm also rector of Garland College's Hall of Residence, which you can see out of the window there. Doesn't it look lovely, all covered with snow? Like a beer barrel in winter. A lovely beer barrel outside an old pub in winter. A lovely warm pub with... Yes, well, I miss the bar being open too. One of my specialities is old earth history, and there is a tradition, especially in academic circles, of telling unnerving or supernatural stories at this time of year. No, it doesn't sound very relaxing, but it was the contrast, you see. Cold out, warm inside. Yes, well, there are limits to which we're allowed to alter the air conditioning settings, and a spooky story is supposed to inspire a pleasing frisson of tension. If that doesn't sound fun, then at least you can appreciate that, as an exercise in historical reconstruction, tonight is fully catered on the university budget. Ah, you like that bit. So, gather round, sit down, and pretend to look interested. Well, listen to that. As best you can over the aircon. Tap, tap, tap. It's just a loose cable slapping against the window, but it reminds me of another winter break, years ago. Riccadelle was a small junk world in the Pentax system and, due to its position and orbit, the seasons changed every 3 days. Blazing summers, windswept autumns, freezing winters and springy springs. A year of weather in less than a fortnight. As a junk world, it had no calendar of its own, so our expedition operated on the old Earth calendar. As the expert in old Earth culture in our group, I was very taken with the idea that we would be experiencing a freezing 3-day winter over the old Christmas holiday. I was the most junior of the expedition, led by Professor Alaman, a Pentakian archaeologist. Anyone from Pentak here tonight? No? Well, Pentakians have blue skin, 4 small black eyes, and white moustaches. No, I didn't check first so I could make stuff up. How dare you? The rest of our expedition were human, including myself. There was Gwyn, a human geophysicist, Meldon, our tech guy, and Emru, a cyberlinguist with a heavily cyber-modified brain. Meldon and Emru were vital to our expedition, as we were on Riccadelle searching for lost Vashar tech and relying on Meldon and Emru to get it working. As I said, Riccadelle was the Pentax system's dumping ground, a junk planet. It was junk we were there for, to wade through the garbage in search of treasure. Treasure that was also garbage, admittedly, but treasure nonetheless. Cultural treasure. You may not have heard of the Vashar. They disappeared over 2 centuries ago, their system left barren. A highly advanced species. Opinion is divided on whether they transcended to another level of being or were wiped out by a solar accident caused by draining power from their own sun and converting it to psionic energy. Either way, the Vashar's entire civilization was gone, leaving other species yearning for their advanced technology and culture. The Vashar had left one legacy behind them. The Vashar loved games, and when they made contact with the Pentax system, they tried to communicate their culture and beliefs through a game, a roughly disc-shaped interactive device. We called them game discs. Unfortunately, paranoia got the better of the Pentax, and the game discs were regarded with suspicion and quietly dumped on Riccadelle. Professor Alaman had grown up with the stories of the Vashar, and our expedition was a fulfilment of his long-held desire to search for the lost game discs. You have a long-held desire for me to get to the point, rude. In that case, I'm going to give you some background colour before moving on, and if you interrupt again, I'll repeat it. We landed on Rickerdell on the 13th of December in the middle of a three-day winter. We had a Caterpillar-tracked garbage truck as our means of transport, loaned from the Pentac Refuse Services, to get around in, and to set out from the spaceport as soon as the thaw allowed. When winter next came, we would need to retreat to one of the Refuse Services outposts, or freeze to death. But in the meantime, we were left camping out while searching for the game discs. Sleeping under the stars, and over hills of accumulated trash. It wasn't the most pleasant expedition I'd been on, no. I don't know if any of you have visited a fully operational junk world, but it is a bizarre environment that operates by its own systems and laws. Thankfully, we didn't need to go anywhere near the toxic zones, or the rot sectors where organic material was given decades to biodegrade into usable elements. We could see some of that activity in the distance as we drove across drifts of dry garbage. Great biomass refineries pumping and processing. The silver towers of methane factories draining gas pockets. It took us a week of surveys and core samples, but on the 20th of December, we believed we had found a payload of Vashar game discs. Another couple of days of hot, sweaty manual work, and we had dug through thickly packed trash and retrieved a motherload of game discs. With our artifacts secured, and the autumn rains beginning to fall, Aloman decided we should break camp early and take our findings to a refuse services outpost for examination. The outpost was a complex of simple prefabricated buildings, settled in a valley between mountains of trash. It wasn't much to look at. There was a central two-story building and a circle of smaller single-story buildings linked by enclosed corridors. The smaller buildings included a garage, sleeping quarters, and the laboratory facilities we would be working in. It was basic accommodation, but after a week out in the trash fields, anywhere with climate control and hot showers seemed like heaven. Yes, heaven, lowercase h, not the other one. That's a different, much longer story. Exhausted, I fell asleep early that night, but found myself restless, disturbed by strange dreams and the sensation of being pulled almost, but not quite, to the brink of waking by some disturbance. After being in a tent for over a week, you would have thought that the outpost would seem quieter, but the whole place seemed to rattle with the rain and wind hammering the exterior, the noise seeping into my dreams. Those dreams were oppressive. Of the drably painted, windowless corridors of the outpost stretching on endlessly, dimly lit and inescapable. I awoke on that last day of autumn, troubled and tetchy. Yes, hard to believe, I know. That day we began to work in the lab. Under Meldon's guidance, we set up a containment unit which would allow us to recharge the game discs under controlled conditions. The discs had shown signs of recharging from the sun the moment we dug them up, so we put them under a large solar lamp. The containment unit had an inbuilt electromagnetic pulse generator to fry the discs if they did anything suspicious, a precaution demanded by the Pentac authorities as a condition for our expedition. The Vashar game discs didn't look harmful. They were flat discs, made of some kind of dark red ceramic, inlaid with strips of brass-like metal. On those strips were etched the word "Hello" in many human and non-human languages. On the top of each disc were four friendly, brightly coloured touchpads, while on the rear were images of male and female Vashar, much like the images of humans portrayed on the earliest space probes. The Vashar had wide heads, giant eyes, long arms, even longer, dexterous fingers, but squat bodies and very short legs. Aloman's theory was that they evolved with abundant plant life and no natural predators, allowing them to sit and create rather than run and forage. With that freedom, they steadily build a technological utopia where solar energy was converted into psionic power that could manipulate the world around them through thought alone. By the end of that day, the charging test was up and running, and we broke to have our meal together back in the canteen. As night fell, we could see the frost beginning to form on the windows and a gentle snow fall across the garbage dunes. Winter had arrived, and Christmas was coming. While Meldon headed back to the lab to check on his experiments before turning in for the night, the rest of us stayed up a little later than we should have, watching the snow and discussing the winter festivals we had experienced on our homeworlds. In contrast to the previous night, I slept heavily and dreamlessly, dozing off with pleasant thoughts of snow blanketing the world outside. I think I would have slept through to mid-morning if it hadn't been for a crash and a scream. I was out of bed and out of the door of my room in less than a minute. The one positive legacy of my time in the military is that I can sleep anywhere and wake up fast when I need to. Sorry, I should have explained the layout of the compound better for the next bit to make sense. The whole place was arranged as a wheel, with the central two-story hub of communal space in the centre and individual windowless, fully covered corridors led out from the central hub building to the other blocks. For convenience of access, as well as the spoke corridors, there were also shorter corridors linking each of the outer blocks, forming a ring around the outside of the complex. Does that make sense? Good. Now you've got that in your head. Here's how the sleeping quarters were laid out. It was a low, single-story building with small bedrooms on each side of a central corridor. In terms of the outer corridors, the sleeping block was one remove clockwise from the labs, and my room was near the door. Which meant that when Meldon crashed through the double doors from the corridor that led to the labs, screaming out as he did so, I was the first to reach him. He had only screamed once, and was on all fours, panting and looking ready to vomit as I ran up to him. His eyes were wild and unfocused, and I approached carefully. "He touched me," he said between ragged breaths. "He grabbed me." He raised himself up to his knees and pulled on his T-shirt to indicate where he had been touched. "Long fingers, digging in." He took his forefinger away and pointed at his chest, just below the ribcage. "Here. And here."
"What was that?" "This is surprisingly verbatim. Well, look, I took notes at the time, and my memory may have been a little sharper during that expedition due to alcohol being banned on Riccadel. Can I carry on now?"
Everyone was out of their bedrooms by then. Alemán had Gwyn run to the kitchens for hot, sweet tea, and after Meldon had been put to bed and sipped on his tea, his story began to come together. He had left us the night before to go and check on the discs, but what he had found there had kept him in the lab. In only a few short hours, they were demonstrating tremendous power build-up, not enough to warrant stopping the experiments, but enough to warrant monitoring. In the early hours, Meldon had succumbed to exhaustion and fallen asleep in his chair. He was woken by a touch on his shoulder. Not suddenly. It didn't jolt him awake. He was gently roused by the pressure. He shifted under it, found himself partially restrained, and froze. Wide awake and in the full conviction that the hand on his shoulder was not that of anyone he knew. The three fingers were far too long, reaching down to his lower ribs. The light was dim in the laboratory, but in the glass front of the containment unit, Meldon could see a rough shadow behind him, a low, wide head just behind his chair. More clearly, he could see the thin, pale fingers stretching over the black fabric of his shirt. As he watched, the forefinger flexed and tapped him gently on the chest. Tap, tap, tap. It was too much. Meldon had jerked around in his chair, pulling himself away from the grip of this long-fingered hand, and run for help, finding me. After telling his story, Meldon gradually settled and eventually slept. It would have been easy to dismiss the entire tale as the result of sleep deprivation and overexcitement, if not for the fact of four small purple bruises on his skin, corresponding to pressure from three long fingers and a thumb. You may well gasp. None of us initially made any connection between the game discs and what Meldon experienced, even if the physical description seemed to suggest the Vashar. After all, the Vashar were long dead. Instead, we presumed the incident was the result of an intruder, or maybe some kind of vermin, so we did the usual checks of doors and vents. By lunch, the rest of us had put what happened to Meldon out of our mind as just one of those strange incidents that occurs on expeditions, and moved on. We had work to do, and, as I couldn't stop reminding people, it was Christmas Eve. By the afternoon, the discs were fully charged and ready for use, the metallic strips and coloured touchpads glowing. It was time to move to direct interaction. This was Emru's role, with Alaman closely monitoring and advising. If anything went awry, the cybernetic part of Emru's brain would provide a failsafe for her human mind. She would then drop the disc back into the containment unit and fry it with the EMP generator. The trick would be to make sure the door was shut in time, or the EMP would also fry every circuit in the lab, including Emru's cybernetic implants. When Emru picked up a disc, it activated instantly, filling the air around us with words. Hello, greetings, welcome, all in a dozen languages. It could have been discordant, but somehow the message was gentle, encouraging. It's trying to make a psionic connection, said Emru, her face lit by the glow, asking for permission to do so.
If you are comfortable, said Alaman, then proceed.
Emru frowned, then visibly relaxed. She looked around the room, delighted, staring into the middle distance. She stood up and began to manipulate the unit with her fingers and thumbs. Spectacular, she said, grinning. I presumed she was experiencing some kind of simulation, projected straight into her brain. It raised a question I probably should have asked earlier. How do we bring her out if we need to? Alaman was about to answer, but Emru looked straight at me. I'm still here, Benny, she said. I have to admit, I flinched. It's less intrusive than any simulation I've experienced. The real and the unreal just overlap. Part of me is exploring the Vashar homeworld, but it's not overwhelming. It's like a daydream unfolding in part of my mind.
Are there any invasive signs? Asked Alaman.
Emru shook her head. It's a very gentle stimulation of the surface consciousness, she said. Nothing intrusive. This was very exciting, as it meant that, pending a few more tests, the rest of us could have a go. We were not, I should add at this point, completely heartless. We checked in on Meldon regularly. Neither were we stupid or careless. Testing was restricted to the lab, with two discs in use at a time, one person operating them while another observed. Nevertheless, the excitement was tremendous. It was exactly as Emru said. To operate a disc was to push a small, dreamy part of your mind into the Vashar's old world and explore it. The green mountains, the solar towers, the way psionics allowed objects to be moved, even altered by the force of the mind alone. We felt we were learning so much, and eating together late that night, we couldn't stop discussing our every finding. The snow had laid so thick outside, reaching up to the first floor and burying the entire landscape, that it was hard to remember we were on a desolate junk world. Instead, we were a group of academics working together on a project we loved, snowed in with our research on Christmas Eve. It was the scholarly adventure I'd always dreamed of. For Meldon's sake, we ended the day by securing the discs in the containment unit and locking ourselves in the accommodation block. The entire ground floor was buried in snow, so there was no way anyone could get in, and we were sure we would rest easy. I dreamed of the Vashar and their home world, of my mind shaping the world around me. I looked down at my long-fingered hands, the tips glowing, and felt the psionic energy flow through me. I seemed to be consumed by that glow. Then I woke up to a gentle tapping on my door. It wasn't urgent, so I didn't roll out of bed on full alert as I had the previous night. I padded across to the door, presuming that Meldon had caused some disturbance. My fuzzy head full of the conflicting emotions of sympathy and annoyance. Then I opened the door of my room to no one. Stepping out into the corridor, I looked either way. Empty. Doors closed. If anyone had been out there, I would have heard the door shut behind them, just as my own door clicked shut behind me with a reassuring thunk. I was just about to return to bed when the tapping on the door began again. This time, from the other side. I recoiled instinctively. Then my youthful bravado kicked in and I flung the door open. There was no one in my room, and it was too narrow for anyone to hide. The tapping had stopped. I experimented with closing the door from both sides and waiting. But the tapping didn't resume. It must have been some illusion of sound, a dripping in the plumbing, somehow echoing through the walls. I returned to bed and was undisturbed the rest of the night. When I woke up on Christmas morning, I had forgotten my odd experience, and no one else mentioned being disturbed. Instead, we were all excited to get to work. Even Meldon was back to his old self and wanted to experience a disc for himself. Although Christmas Day was not a holiday celebrated in the Pentax system, I informed everyone that, according to my research, sitting around playing video games was in fact an ancient Earth seasonal custom, so we could work and celebrate at the same time. So that's what we did. Sitting around the lab, taking turns to play with the discs, comparing experiences and making notes. The experience was simple enough. Holding the unit in your hands, you made psionic contact with it, and then you interacted with the game through a combination of manipulating the coloured touchpads and applying your will, consciously deciding what to do. While the unit had spoken in many languages when activated, use of language seemed absent from the experience itself, much to Alamand's frustration. Nonetheless, we were making progress with our individual games. Exploring the Vashar homeworld and experiencing moments of Vashar life led us all down different aspects of their culture, history and science. I followed a path of the evolution of their cities from small habitations to elaborate, technologically advanced structures, needles of polished metal piercing the sky, reaching for the sun that provided their power. Then what I was experiencing snapped back to smaller communities, as if returning to some previous epoch where the Vashar led simpler lives in smaller groups. We discussed our experiences over a Christmas lunch of basic rations. We were so excited about our discoveries, I didn't even bother to steer the conversation onto crackers and party hats. As we returned to the lab, we had another unusual experience. There was a trail of wet patches in the corridor between the lab and the main block, almost like very long, flat footprints. We shrugged and put it down to a leak, the snow getting in from outside, although none of us could find any signs of damp on the ceiling and walls. The afternoon's work was more frustrating than the morning. The game seemed to loop around, resisting progress beyond a certain point, and without language the meaning was rather opaque. Yes, the Vashar had a charming culture, strangely agrarian in spite of their high technology, but it was unclear what the point of it all was. The Vashar made these things to send a message, but what was it? Late afternoon, Gwyn snapped. Their nerves frayed. They told Emru to stop that bloody tapping. When asked what Gwyn meant, the geophysicist used their finger to tap several times on the table, then said that, as if resting their case. Except Emru hadn't been tapping. The rest of us all agreed. Aloman decided that was enough work with the discs for today. Simulation sickness is a well-known side effect of virtual immersion, and if one of us was showing signs of confusion between reality and the game, then we all needed a break. We spent a couple of hours piecing together what had been learnt so far. Then Aloman insisted we break from work altogether. Over dinner, I was practically press-ganged by the professor into telling the group everything I knew about 20th century Christmas traditions on Earth. I realised he was forcing us to think about anything other than the Vashar to regain some distance. But I'm not ashamed to say I enjoyed the spotlight. The folly of youth. I would never be that hungry for attention now. As we were returning to the accommodation block, we heard a tapping. It seemed to be coming from outside the prefabricated walls of the corridor, as if someone was running back and forth outside, drumming their fingers on the walls. It was rhythmic, persistent.
"We need to check outside," said Aloman. "There could be someone."
Meldon cut him off mid-sentence.
"There's no one," he snapped,
a little of the previous day's mania rising.
"It's a drip. Or panels flexing in the cold. We need to ignore it."
The tapping ceased, and we all took a breath, not sure what to do next. Then Gwyn lifted their hand to the wall and started to tap with a forefinger. 1, 2, 3 times. Tap, tap, tap. The tap was returned 3 times, exactly the same tempo. "That's no drip," I said redundantly. We hurried through to the accommodation block and locked ourselves in once more. There was nothing we could do this late at night, frozen into the complex. We agreed that 2 of us should be awake on watch in case one of us became manic again in the night. Aloman and I took first shift. Sat on uncomfortable utility chairs in the corridor.
"What if we're getting them wrong?"
I asked quietly. I had a blanket over my knees and my feet pulled up onto the chair, trying to get as comfy as possible. Aloman looked at me with his 4 small black eyes, waiting for me to expand my thought.
"What if the Vashar aren't showing us their history out of order? Reverting to their past?"
I said.
"What if it's linear? As their psionic abilities increased, they simplified and streamlined, and their cities shrunk back to villages."
"What about the population?"
asked Aloman.
"Those small communities couldn't fit the same amount of Vashar as the great cities."
"Well, perhaps their population declined," I said.
"They lost some reproductive urge. Disappeared into themselves."
I remembered my dream, the Vashar hands disappearing into a flurry of psionic energy.
"Maybe they were absorbed into the psionic force themselves. That's where they went.
And by interacting with the units, we're bringing them back,"
asked Aloman.
"Or we're just reviving their memory, but the game discs make those memories feel real."
"Should old acquaintance be forgot?" said Aloman. "That's a human Christmas phrase, isn't it?"
"New Year," I said, smiling in spite of myself.
"Not Christmas, but close." "Then we ring in the New Year early when morning comes," he said. "Destroy the discs."
We swapped shift with Meldon and Emru in the early hours and spent a restless few hours sleeping. I had a dream, where I would be woken by a tapping, then realize I was still asleep, then be woken by a tapping. A loop of imaginary wakings that left me in a fog when Alamon woke me for real. It was time. As a group, we went through to the laboratory, and with a certain reverence and regret, we moved the discs and all the broken pieces we had retrieved into the containment units. Meldon sealed the door and released an electromagnetic pulse. The discs sparked and died. Our project destroyed by our own hands, we spent the morning under a cloud. We all wished to get out of that place as soon as we could, but opening any exterior door revealed why we couldn't. The compacted snow had solidified into a wall of ice. It was only the heating circuits within the complex that were keeping us alive.
"We leave first thing tomorrow, after the thaw," Alamon told us.
He suggested that we spend the day packing our equipment and collating our research. In spite of the curtailing of our project, we had learned a considerable amount about the Vashar and should find encouragement in that. Indeed, as we started to look at what we had done in the lab, the mood lifted. Our work had been good, and we had even proven the Pentak authorities were right to dump the Vashar discs in the first place. I was beginning to feel that I'd had a lot worse boxing days in my life when Emru fell to her knees, complaining of a pain in her head.
"It's reaching into my skull," she moaned, slumped forward.
"Oh no," said Gwyn, backing towards the wall, and I could see Meldon having a similar reaction.
"We don't know if what Emru is experiencing is related to what we felt before," said Alamon, trying to be the voice of reason. "We all know what's in her skull," snapped Meldon. "A finger. One of their fingers."
Emru was bent down now, face to the floor, and her fingers were drumming on the surface of the floor, the same rhythmic tapping as we had heard before.
"It could still be a coincidence,"
said Alamon, but I could tell his heart wasn't in it. Then Emru sat bolt upright, her face slack and vacant, and it felt as if the walls of the lab were melting, becoming translucent. And on those walls were the shadows of squat figures outside, tapping to get in. Tap, tap, tap. And beyond them still, there were the green fields of the Vashar homeworld, as if we could leave the complex and be on that tranquil world.
"They must have got into Emru's circuits," said Alamon. "Maybe the circuits of this whole place."
"I can't take this," said Gwyn, sliding down a wall I could barely see.
"I can't take this."
If this carried on, we would lose ourselves, overwritten by the Vashar's memories of themselves. I staggered over to the containment unit and pulled open the door. If I left the door open and activated the largest electromagnetic pulse I could, it would spread outwards. "Sorry, Emru," I said. I didn't know whether this would work, but I knew it would damage her cybernetic implants. I cranked the EMP generator up to max and switched it on. There was a fizzing crack as every circuit in hearing range, including those within Emru's skull, burnt out all at once, and we were plunged into darkness. The Vashar homeworld and their strange, tapping shadows disappeared, leaving us alone in the cold and dark. What else is there to say? We nearly died overnight, as with no power there was no heating. We huddled together in the canteen on the first floor, blankets piling over us, trying to stay warm until daylight came. Gwyn and Meldon were heavily traumatized, while the disabling of Emru's cybernetic implants had left her impaired and suffering seizures. We made it through the night, though. And the next morning, spring had begun to thaw the ice down to a level where we could get our transport, which, blessedly, had enough analog parts to work with its circuitry burnt out. We drove away from there, glad to be alive, even though we really didn't know whether what had happened to us was an attack or a disastrous attempt at communication. Whatever the cause, it was years until I could hear a tapping on the door without... Wait, that tapping. Could it...
It'll be Joseph with the run. Someone let him in.
Why, yes, I did time that well.
Merry Christmas.